fucking loser's game! You're the fucking loser's game! I hate Nicky Cowan! I hate Nicky Cowan! He's smiling! He wasn't smiling before! He's smiling! Really wants to go out there, you go! I wanna praise you like I should! You have to dance around like this fucking video! Motherfucking son of a bitch!
Back another episode here of Allow Me to Be Frank. As September comes to an end, baseball season ends, team is playing like they've already folded into tents and are dying. Hopefully that means a new manager. And football is now fully underway. We've already been through three games. Just think, after this week, it will be a quarter of the way through the season, and lots to talk about this weekend. Once again, I'm joined by my social media guy, Nick Buono, Patrick Ragazzo, and we have a special guest today, a guy who follows the Tampa Bay Buccaneers really close. Steve, what can you say?
Sure. Yeah, my name's Steve Che. I work at Barstool. I've worked at Barstool about 3 years. I actually know Nick from college. He now lives like two towns away from me in Jersey. Fellow NJ Transit Commuters Daily. I have a podcast at Barstool, a Surf and Turf podcast. We deal a lot with former NFL players and do long-form interviews, premium interviews. This week we got Tiki Barber dropping Thursday. So that's out now. So go listen, subscribe, review. Really fun interview. I was at Daniel Jones's first game. I was in Tampa for the game. Full transparency, I was actually a big Daniel Jones guy coming out. I thought the Bucs were actually going to be potentially looking at quarterback, and Daniel Jones was kind of the apple of my eye in this class the whole time. So I was actually pretty excited to see his debut, and he certainly lived up to the hype, the preseason hype.
What made you like him when he was coming out of Duke?
A lot of things. I mean, you look at, like, prototypical size. The one knock on him is, like, doesn't have, like, A-plus arm strength. But to make up for that, he does throw with good anticipation. He has good accuracy, good size, and he can move. He's not I don't want to say he's Cam Newton as far as running the ball, but he is similar size and speed to Cam Newton.
Yeah, he definitely showed off his wheels on Sunday. And you know, the rap on him was that his arm really wasn't, you know, everyone said he had a weaker arm, but I think that he's kind of, you know, disproven that notion that he has a weak arm. You definitely saw it on display on Sunday with that scrambling throw, in particular the 47-yard bomb to Darius Slayton. That was, yep, like his most impressive throw of the game, I think.
Easily, yep.
I think Steven, one of the things about you that's interesting that others may not know, but I have the inside track here, is that going back to, obviously we went to college together, I think the first time we met was on the intramural fields playing flag football. Pretty confident Steven's team won, and you just got to think, like, he was just laying the land for just like defensive efforts and be able to exploit systems. And it's just kind of crazy how now we're doing this podcast today. We're both taking the same NJ Transit train. 15 years later, and here you are. I think one of the things we wanted to get to before we dive into like kind of the game and whatnot is like, how did you end up there? I assume you had some connections there, but like, how did that whole process start? Where like, okay, I'm going to that game specifically.
Sure. So kind of a crazy story. Jason Light is the general manager of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He has been since 2014. He's been on Good Morning Football and a bunch of other media hits, NFL Total Access, et cetera, and has like a really good personality and is like very personable with the media. Pardon My Take is Barstool's number one sports podcast, and they have interviewed a few GMs and head coaches and just high-ranking NFL officials. I thought Jason would be a perfect fit for Pardon My Take. So for about a year and a half, maybe now, I've been emailing with Bucks PR about potentially getting Jason on the show. I've also been trying to get Cam Brate on the show, who has now become a friend of mine. he showed up to training camp 2 years ago in a Chaw Dog shirt. So I was like, obviously he's a fan. He's got a Viva La Stool sticker in his locker. So I thought he would be great as well. So I've been kind of talking with Bucks PR, et cetera. It was this past, we actually thought we might be able to interview him at the combine. It turns out Jason Light got surgery right around that time, so it wasn't really going to be a good fit for the time. But I wanted to stay in touch. So a story came out on Pro Football Talk that someone alerted me of, and it was that two fans had made a charitable donation, a pretty sizable charitable donation, to the a charity of the 49ers, I think John Lynch's choosing, and they got to be in the draft room for the 49ers this year. So I proposed a similar situation with Jason, substituting some stuff. It certainly wasn't like a large amount of money, but I basically made an offer somewhat comparable for the Bruce Arians Foundation to somewhat link up with stuff that we do. And I was like, I would love to be in the draft room. I'm like, I'm a huge NFL draft guy. I went to the NFL draft for like 7 straight years in the, from when I was in college to like right after, until basically I moved out of New York. And to my surprise, he not only received my email, but he wrote me back in like 30 minutes and, you know, appreciated the effort. He declined my offer, but he did say that if I was ever in Tampa, he would love to have me as a guest at training camp. It turns out, for my job at Barstool, I actually sit on top of all the inventory for the podcast. So our podcast network has, you know, hundreds of advertisers, and I kind of sit on top of that once it's been sold and distributed, et cetera. So we had a podcast conference this year. Last year was in Philadelphia. This year was in Orlando, which is very close to Tampa. So when the dates were announced, I was, you know, hoping it would overlap with training camp. It did. And when the Bucks released their training camp schedule, I emailed my friend Jason and said, hey, you know, I'm going to be in town for work these days. I can come, you know, a day or two early, and, you know, I'd love to be your guest, you know, take you up on your offer. And not only was he, like, super accommodating, he was very happy that I did that.
So Steve, so you're blushing right now just based on the invite. My question is, so just getting to, like, kind of know you is that I know, like, you got a family, you got a wife. Like, yep. how do you pull this shit off right now? How are you making this happen? What's behind the scenes? The people need to know more than just what they, you know, what they see on the Barstool.
Sure. Yeah. So, yep, my kid is about to turn 1 in about 2.5 weeks. I have a wife. She's going to be getting home in about 10 minutes from like a work outing. I do this certainly in my spare time, but, like kind of after hours, after the kid goes to sleep, my wife works very hard. You know, in this day and age, you know, with laptops and smartphones, we take our work home with us a lot.
Right.
So, I choose to do that, but, you know, do something I'm extremely passionate about, which is, you know, the Bucks All 22. I've been breaking down Bucks All 22 on Twitter for 5 years now. It's my 5th season.
4 years, kind of, 4 years to a black hole, which is what Prez said. And yeah. Now a year into the actual internet.
I had before I went to Barstool, I had maybe about 2,000 followers that, you know, mainly Florida based, that would, you know, consume my content. And now it's much larger than that, which I'm very grateful for.
Awesome. Yeah. Frank, you have any being a Dolphins fan, and obviously the Bucks are like kind of, you know, not they're not the Dolphins. We're not going to insult the Bucks like that, but. How are you feeling about kind of like the Bucks fan base? What do you think? Do you see any parallels there?
Well, the Florida fan base is a peculiar one. I don't think there's a more fair-weather fan than the Florida fan base. I mean, there's so many empty seats in Miami games right now. Some guy tried to sell his tickets at Publix. He came back in 2 days later, and he found he had more tickets given to him.
God.
I mean, I hear that they're to get a VIP experience at a Dolphin game right now. It's $75.
Frank, why did the Dolphins pick up Taco Charlton? They're tanking. Like, what was the? That was just a little confusing for me as to why they even went out and signed him. when the Cowboys cut him.
Because maybe he has a pulse, and that's the only thing required right now to play for the Miami Dolphins, to actually be alive.
I think it's a good boomer bust signing. I mean, it's low risk. You can cut him if it doesn't work out. If it does work out, he was a former first-round pick, and he certainly got talent.
I mean, I actually now picture the Dolphins' war room being like that scene in Major League. Okay, can we sign this guy? He's dead. Okay, cross him off the list.
Well, it's like when the Mets pronounced the one of the members of the 69 team dead this summer. When the guy was that was just a nightmare on the list of nightmares of the Mets over the years. But yeah, I want to jump back real quick though and talk about the game on Sunday. So, what did you see from Jones in his debut? I mean, what can you say about him? Like, the poise and the composure were you know, very impressive alone. But what did you see up close and personal?
I would say accuracy. He was very accurate on a lot of his balls. I think his worst ball, he overthrew a deep ball. And then there was the one catch on third down that Evan Ingram made, like, a ridiculous catch, like, behind him over his head and then kind of
one hand, yeah.
Yep. First down. The one thing he would need to improve is maybe just, like, awareness. I think overall he did okay. Shaq Barrett's playing out of his mind right now. He's 8 sacks in 3 games and got some a few times, got the ball out a little bit. So maybe protecting the ball in the pocket. But I think, and, you know, I foresaw this coming for quite a while, is just his speed. There was one play. I might actually be putting out a breakdown of Daniel Jones on Thursday. I'm going to be working with Clem on that. But I'm trying to get a bunch of 5-star reviews for Surf and Turf. If we get to 21 by Thursday when Tiki Barber comes out, I'm going to put out the Daniel Jones clips because I did his All-22 as well. The most impressive and underrated play that he had was the second play of the second quarter. It was about 14:45 left. It was 3rd and 5. And Daniel Jones, it was a drop back pass. He rolled out of the pocket. Shaq Barrett, the reigning NFC Defensive Player of the Week, had him and was spying him, took an angle on him, and Daniel Jones just outran him. He beat him around the corner and picked up 11 yards first down. I think that really shows his mobility and speed and just overall awareness. There was another play where it was just a play action. He was rolling out to the right side, and Carl Nassib was disciplined, played the pass, dropped back, and then charged him immediately. And, you know, you got a 275-pound guy barreling down on you. He makes a very accurate on-time throw and just takes the hit. I think a lot of that was very, very promising. I mean, in addition to the two big throws he had was the one that, Pat, you mentioned, the one where he was rolling left, and it was like a 45-yard pass to Slayton.
Yeah, to Jerry Slayton.
Second touchdown pass, I believe, was just an unbelievable throw. It was maybe a 10-yard pass, but it was just like perfectly lofted in double coverage. The receiver was not open. And I think it was Sterling Shepard. He threw him open. Yep. He threw it to a spot where basically only Shepard could get the ball. And that was a very, very impressive play in a spot where he had almost no window.
And that's the thing with Jones, too, like that we saw in the preseason. Now, and I'm a very optimistic Giants fan. I always have been, and I've taken a lot of heat for it. I'm pro Dave Gettleman. I go against the national narrative that he's clueless and he doesn't know what he's doing, because, you know, and look at it, you know, I was kind of celebrating after Sunday, you know, the rookies, not just Jones, played a huge impact in that win on Sunday. You know, they all looked pretty good. Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah. And they, and Dexter Lawrence, he had that blocked extra point, which, you know, wound up being the difference maker, honestly, in the game. But other than that, they got huge contributions from fifth-round picks in Darius Slayton and Ryan Connolly on defense. DeAndre Baker was their first-round pick, and he looked terrible in the first 2 weeks, but he really, really improved on Chris Godwin, who's looked great in the first two games this season. He's coming off the 120-yard receiving game against the Panthers the week before. But the thing is, too, like, another thing with Jones, like, you know, he got hit 18 times, or he got hit 10 times, pressured 18, sacked 5 times. The Bucs defense, you know, they're no slouches. You know, I mean, they were missing Devin White, and, you know, the secondary was struggling in the second half. You know, they weren't really covering anyone. That Ingram play in particular, you know, he was one-on-one there with, I don't know who it was, probably like a safety, I imagine.
Touchdown?
Yeah.
It was a botched coverage. It was a zone, and two guys went to the same spot, so he kind of had a vacated area.
Steve, yeah, but give credit to Slayton, too. Slayton had a good block downfield, though,
too. Kind of holes, but yes.
Yeah.
Quick question, Steven. So given kind of like your new, like your role now, it's like you are the Bucks guy. And obviously, you know, you doing what you do at Barstool. Do you take notes at these games? Like, do you have a notepad like with you on hand, or is this from the film? Like, what do you spit to us right now? Is that from the film breakdown, or when you're at the game, are you a pure fan, or are you legit like looking at it the way that kind of we hear you on a, you know, daily basis break this stuff down?
So I would say I lean more towards pure fan. Like, there are some people that go and like chart the games, and what I mean by that is they'll take, they'll take notes on every possession. They'll say, okay, we're in 11 personnel. You know, we got 13 personnel, we got 22 personnel, etc. They'll take notes on that and like how often they pass and run to just kind of make sure that it's a balanced attack. I'm not one of those people. I think very few people do that, but some people do. When I'm watching the game live, I'm watching it for the most part as a fan. I will have different observations. So, for example, after the first series, you could tell the Giants defensively had a specific plan. Bruce Arians and the Bucks, their offense is a throw it down the field vertical offense. It's predicated on a deep ball. The issue with their entire offense is the quarterback, Jameis Winston, does not throw a good or accurate deep ball. So that's kind of why you see a lot of problems with their offense. The Giants, what they did is because the Bucs have had a decent rushing attack the first few weeks. The Giants played 8 in the box almost every possession or every play on the first possession. So they're essentially daring Jameis Winston to throw deep. The issue is that Jameis Winston actually does have a decent connection deep with Mike Evans.
So I know he does. After I played him in fantasy.
Yeah.
Is Jameis Winston a bust?
You want to see him with a full year with this coaching, but it's certainly trending that way.
I mean, his behavior at times is peculiar. Eating to win. He has had some off-field troubles. I honestly don't understand why the Buccaneers did not attempt to look at another quarterback.
I think that they will. There is certainly confidence within the organization. I think he played very well on Sunday. There was the one complete bonehead throw. The interception was a horrendous interception.
Do you think you can win a Super Bowl with him? Do you think you can win a Super Bowl with him?
Is he a confetti quarterback where I could envision it? As of right now, no. He has not shown anything that gives me that confidence that he could be a Super Bowl winning guy.
You and Frank have created quite a different dynamic for what me and Pat usually see when teams don't do well. Like the way you react and the way Frank react is kind of I don't think we could find two polar opposites right now.
I mean, I suffered 7 years under Ryan Trashy Hill, and you see what it's taken Dolphins. I mean, I think at times if you need to realize sooner that the quarterback is not good and cut bait.
Yes, I agree with that. Right now, the alternatives are not super appealing. We have Ryan Griffin, who's a solid player as far as a backup. He's been like third string. He's been a backup before. He hasn't played a single NFL snap. He's not like a strong arm guy. He's had decent preseasons, but you know, there's not a big alternative. The whole reason Bruce Arians was brought in is to kind of with the hope that Jameis will have like one of these Carson Palmer type turnarounds. The one thing I will give Jameis a pass for, and this isn't his fault, is he's had the same offensive coordinator for his entire career. So he's been under Dirk Cutter. Dirk Cutter's offense doesn't necessarily suit Jameis Winston well. So they bring in a guy who's a quote-unquote quarterback whisperer, that was the title of his book, to hopefully turn him around. I'm willing to give him a little bit of rope or leash for this year. He's not under contract next year. I would think that the Bucs are going to investigate that in the draft if they don't play well. So we'll see. I will say that the organization is quietly confident that he's going to have a good year.
One thing that shift gears a little bit here, some disappointing news coming from that game. One of the game's best players and running backs, of course, Saquon Barkley, suffering the high ankle sprain and now is expected to miss 4 to 8 weeks. That's a huge disappointment for the Giants. But honestly, that made Jones's first win even more impressive, that he played 75% of the game without Saquon. And when Saquon was in, the Bucs defense, you know, stuffed him the whole time. He had 8 carries for 10 yards. They were loading the box on him too.
Ironically, the Saquon Barkley injury hurt the Bucks and helped the Giants in the long run because, yes, they were not rushing the ball effectively at all. The Bucks swallowed him up. They were a very good run defense.
Right. And, yeah, as one that was quite devastated, I'm a well-known owner of Saquon Barkley in fantasy football, and I just couldn't watch that. Like, to me, the hardest part was enjoying. I wanted to enjoy the Daniel Jones win so much, but as seriously and as psychotic as I take fantasy, I had nothing left in the tank. I mean, you guys saw my tweets. They were irrational. I was off the mark. I embarrassed myself, but
he said you said Daniel Jones had a bad first half.
No, I'll say it. Daniel Jones looks fucking terrible, which he didn't at all. It was just, I was mad because of the production that Barkley was getting. And I had like drunk glasses on. So like, if he didn't throw the ball to Barkley in the flat.
I've worn those glasses before.
Yeah, it's like you can't, I could not see straight. Like I could not watch and evaluate the game correctly. And I was looking at it from a fantasy football perspective rather than like an NFL perspective. And then I go back and I watch the game film and I'm like, for the kid's first start, it's literally probably like, it's one of the greatest debuts.
Kurt Warner said he made almost every correct read and more so than like a very good NFL quarterback in his first start. So
that's why I'm sitting here and not, you know, evaluating game film.
Yeah, I will say that Saquon dropped a pretty easy walk-in touchdown in the first quarter.
He tried to one-hand it.
Jones,
yeah, and then the next play, Jones showed off his speed with the read option rushing touchdown. That was impressive, too, to beat the defensive back to the goal line. He didn't just exceed expectations, he shattered them, looking like a seasoned vet. And, you know, that's what we saw in preseason. I was at his first preseason game for that drive against the Jets, and I was like, holy shit. Like, I was expecting him to be shitting himself, be nervous, like, you know, not have poise or composure, and that's exactly what he has, you know, and that's what he's always had. He's kind of like Eli, you know, more even keel, but even Eli struggled early on in his career. The one thing he needs to clean up, obviously, is the fumbles. He has a good amount of fumbles in his games dating back to college, and he had two the other day, and, you know, part of that was Nate Solder getting absolutely worked on the edge by Barrett. Yeah, he had a poor first half of the season last year. He picked it up a bit in the second half. He's just like one of these things where like left tackles don't grow on trees, and like he's a lot better than what the Giants had with Eric Flowers for like 3 years playing left tackle. So he's still not that bad of an option.
Did you watch Eric Flowers last night?
No, I didn't get to see that actually. What happened? How bad was he?
Basically, Khalil Mack spent all game in the Redskins' backfield.
They were praising him, though. They were praising him. The announcers were praising Flowers. And I had to, like, take a double take. I was like, the guy doesn't know how to walk backwards. Like, he doesn't know how to do that. They were being very, very, generous.
Eric Flowers is so bad. It'd actually be better off. You're better off putting a pod plant on the offensive line than Eric Flowers. I mean, people go through him like he's a revolving door.
Yeah, he's not good. I mean, what was he? I think he was like the 9th overall pick that year, and that was the same year as what Gurley came out and Gordon. It was like the Knicks. It was like the Knicks thing when we didn't get Steph Curry. And we got, what was that bum's name?
Channing Frye. Or no, Jordan Hill.
Jordan Hill. It's Jordan Hill.
Oh my God.
We would have taken Curry too. That's the most depressing thing because he fit the scheme that we were trying to go for.
Now, Steve, you're a Bucks fan and, you know, you're very knowledgeable about the NFL. Do you know the real reason why the Giants went from being a playoff contender pretty much for 8 straight years to the shithole that they've been the last, like, 6 out of 7 seasons?
I mean, I know they haven't had great play at the quarterback position, but I haven't studied them well. But I know that their draft picks haven't been stellar. I mean, Eric Flowers, you mentioned Eli Apple.
Bingo. And you know whose fault that was? Jerry Reese, who took over as general manager in 2007, had a decent draft that year. They won the Super Bowl with Ernie Accorsi, of course, the legend general manager's core that he built with that team. And then, you know, he made a couple, you know, minor moves. Kenny Phillips, Mario Manningham, Hakeem Nicks. He found Cruz. He drafted JPP. So those were a couple good moves. But if you go back and look at all his mid-round picks those years, yes, if he built off the core and they were able to win another Super Bowl, but all those mid-round picks did not make it afterwards. They all never even became starters. And then after that, once these guys aged, you know, moved on, whatever, after the second Super Bowl, he did not – he hit on, I think, about 6 out of 80 draft picks for this decade. I'm not even kidding. That's not an exaggeration. Mm-hmm. And if he didn't draft Odell Beckham, he would have been fired 2 years earlier. And the problem really is the thing with Jerry Reese, John Mara goes – this is John Mara's fault too, because he goes, oh, Jerry needs to be better. And then that sprung the 2016 spending spree where they brought in Snacks Harrison. They brought in Janoris Jenkins. They spent money like crazy, and now they have so many cap issues, and people want to blame it on Dave Gettleman when really it was Jerry Reese's doing because he couldn't draft. He signed Olivier Vernon away from the Dolphins, who had one good year for the Giants. That 2016 year, it was very good, but he ignored the offensive line as he did for several years, and that's part of the reason that they ruined the rest of Eli's remaining good years. And, you know, they had Eric Flowers at left tackle. The offense was terrible that year. And the only time they ever scored was when Odell would break like a 60-yard slant to the house. And the defense would pitch basically a shutout. So,
Frank,
you can't build through the free agency in football.
I was just going to ask you, Frank. So, like, we talked the Bucs, we talked the Giants. Where did things go? Where did things go south for Miami? Like, when did it – I mean, not that when did it start. I mean, they haven't been good in a long time. But, like, can you –
there's been a long lack of patience in Miami.
Just trying to, like, shotgun wins and just get guys in there, warm bodies.
Yeah. Where Dave tried over and over and over again to bring in a big free agent name. They brought in Ndamukong Suh, who was good but not great. They brought in Kiko Alonso, who was good, not great. They had good drafts at the wide receiver position, but Ryan Tannehill sucked. They drafted okay on the offensive line, but then people got hurt, and then when they came time to pay him, they couldn't pay him because their salary cap situation was horrendous. So they had to get rid of Pouncey. Then Tannehill, after 7 years, it dawned on them, gee, we can't do anything with him. Meanwhile, they're drafting mid-middle of the first round year after year after year. They're stuck in NFL hell in that like 7-9, 7-8-9 pattern where every year they don't necessarily suck. They're close to 500. They're hovering near 500, and they're just stuck in this pattern of NFL hell. So every year they're picking in the middle of the first round. 13, 14, 15, and they're getting good players, but their middle round picks aren't really hitting, and then there's just a lack of patience. They end up trading players away and letting players go, and then what you have left is what you have left, and what they have left is an expansion team roster.
Yeah, are you happy with the direction that they've decided to go in?
Tank. There's no other word about the Miami Dolphins. They have a guy on their team named Kalen Ballage.
Yep.
His name rhymes with garbage. Who's basically he actually had one good run late in the game against the Cowboys to finally get over negative yards, but he's got like 16 carries this year for 17 yards.
He literally has one good run in per game in Ballage. Like that. Yeah,
the first game he had like 6 carries for negative 5 yards.
Yeah, Frank, what do you think it would take for the Giants to get Kenyon Drake away from the Dolphins?
Second, third round pick.
Not gonna happen. That's not gonna happen.
No, it's not worth a second or third round pick.
Yeah. I don't think it would happen, but I'm just saying. I think that...
once again, here's another guy the Dolphins gave up on. Jay Ajayi's out there.
Because his knees are done.
Yeah. The Giants brought in like Benny Cunningham today. I mean, this is obviously again the fantasy football in me speaking. But it looks like they're going to go with Gallman at least for this first week and see what they got. And I think if he's a total dud, they're going to bring in some actual real names.
Well, they're bringing up my friend John Hillman, of course, the St. Peter's Prep alumni. I interviewed him in the summer. And, yeah, he's like the only other running back on the Giants roster right now. So, at least tailback. So,
Steve, I wanted to obviously, we're hot off the Bucs game. You obviously have been extremely busy over the last few days. And I told you this before, I did listen to Big Cat reading your blog, and I think it was some of the best stuff I've ever heard in my life. What is it like to sit there and just watch that, to be in that room and just watch him read your words as he envisions you writing them? Like, what is that experience, just being in that atmosphere when that happens?
Yeah, I mean, it's fun. Big Cat is certainly a very big personality. He's a super nice guy. I consider him a friend.
Did you see it coming?
I knew we would talk about it. I didn't know that there would be like a, you know, whatever, 20-minute dramatic reading of it. It was interesting because, you know, they obviously perceive me in a certain way, and that's fine. Like, you know, anyone's entitled to perceive however they want. It seems to be consistent throughout at least the host of the show. I'm not like tech savvy enough to really like know Reddit or like beyond really like the comments in the blog. So I don't know how people feel necessarily about me. I knew that I have like these random.
Well, you Twitter, have a Che Hive. You have a Che Hive.
Right, the Twitter like fan clubs, which is very flattering. But
Tank has Tank's army. They're pretty good.
Yeah. I just try to kind of keep my head down and, you know, watch game tape and kind of do the things that I like. I only really like two sports. I like football and basketball. I don't really have time for baseball or hockey or anything else. And I have a pretty narrow focus, but I put a lot of effort into those things.
You're a pro's pro, is what they say. You're a pro's pro at what you do.
There you go. You know,
talking about Twitter armies, Giants Twitter has been a pretty brutal place over the years, especially, you know, of course, with all this losing that's been going on. But sure. Now, since the Saquon injury, no one will shut the hell up about, oh, like, you know, people going back and saying, oh, they shouldn't have drafted a running back at number two last year. And this is the argument I was making. Yes, I believe in positional value. Like, you know, we've seen some running backs get drafted in the mid rounds and play well. Kareem Hunt, Alvin Kamara, et cetera. Rashad Penny's pretty decent, I'd say.
Sure.
But guys like Saquon Barkley and Ezekiel Elliott are generational talents, and they were worth top five picks. And, you know, you can't prove me wrong. The thing is, like, people are complaining because they said, oh, the Giants could have been a year ahead of the rebuild. But, like, I don't believe that because they tried to build off a team last year that they thought could win.
Sure. My two cents on that is I never really liked to pick running backs. I thought Gettleman was crazy for going Saquon number two. I mean, I understand his logic that, you know, he wants a gold jacket player, and a lot of the fear about drafting that high is that you just can't have a bust. Like, you know, Saquon, a very good running back is better. You know, that's a 99% hit chance is better than, you know, an offensive lineman, a receiver, a quarterback with, you know, a much lower percentage hit chance. That I understand. That being said, and this is actually perfect timing, in the interview with Tiki Barber on the Surf and Turf podcast, which is out now, he says that, he talks about the 2006 season where he ran for like 1,600 yards, and as a team, I think the Giants had like 2,100 yards rushing. Yeah. You know, he retired after the 2006 season. There are rumors that he turned down, you know, enormous contract extensions and basically reworked deals to basically retire. But he put it to us this way. He said that, you know, the Giants, you know, of course, he would have liked to have won a Super Bowl and been there for the Super Bowl win. That being said, if you look at the team's total rushing output, they rushed for, like I said, whatever, 2,100 yards in 2006. The 2007 team, which was anchored by Ahmad Bradshaw, I think that was Brandon Jacobs as well.
Yeah.
They rushed for like 2,130 yards. He said the difference was actually like 30 yards, the delta. Like the difference between, you know, him the year before where they had this great rushing attack, whereas the next year they won the Super Bowl, they had you know, basically the same number of yards, just with a like by committee. So he said that that is actually a really good point for devaluing the position, because instead of paying one guy a lot of money, you can pay a bunch of guys not as much money and get basically the same production. Like, obviously for fantasy owners like Nick, who are, you know, pinning their hopes and dreams to a guy that's going to have, you know, 2,000 total yards from scrimmage and 15 touchdowns, that's not what you want to hear. But as far as building a football team and building a team that's going to win on the field, you don't necessarily need to rely on one guy. So Therefore, I was not high. I think Saquon's a great back. I've heard that he, you know, if he fell to number 7 with the Bucs, I probably too would have been very happy. That being said, you know, at number 2, especially if you have a need at quarterback, I thought it was pretty wild to pass up all the quarterbacks, you know, except Baker, obviously, to take a running back.
I tend to agree with kind of that sentiment. Drafting is always hit or miss. I think Gettleman was just honestly just like in love with Saquon Barkley. I mean, he compared him to like he said he was like blessed by the hands of God when they took him.
Yeah, you know, positions I think is now become completely. They got to change the thinking of is the receiver position. I think the diva receiver is just. It's time to just say goodbye to anyone. Find someone that can run and catch, and that's all you need.
Or just be a star and not be a diva. That's my thing. Be DeAndre Hopkins.
Well, look at the Browns now. I mean, Baker Mayfield, yeah, struggling. Odell had that one, you know, 100-yard game against the Jets defense, which they were still throwing the ball when they were up by 20 points. You know, just seemed like just to pad the stats there. But, yeah, you know, it just shows, and the Giants over the years, it shows how valuable the offensive and defensive lines are. That's how you build a winner. You don't build out of the skill positions. We heard it for years. Oh, the Giants have Odell, Sterling Shepard, Evan Ingram, Saquon Barkley, and what did that amount to?
You're weak in the trenches, that's going to show up, and I completely agree. I completely agree with you, Pat, that you know, if you build with skill positions, that leaves the rest of your team weaker, and that eventually in the long run, it's going to get exposed. That's why you don't see, you know, guys who are commanding top dollar and are your best players. Like, rarely do those receivers win championships.
Des Bryant never been to a Super Bowl?
Calvin Johnson.
Calvin Johnson's, that wasn't his fault, and he wasn't a diva.
I mean, he still commanded top dollar. I don't even think it matters, like, personality-wise. Just like
the Detroit Lions just can't build a football team.
I think what we're talking about here is it's all about the system. And speaking of that, so I actually reached out to Twitter just now, Steven. And before we let you go, there actually is a question for you.
Sure.
Trace Arena asks, he says, do you think the secondary is to blame for the chunk plays in the second half, or do you think it was more due to Bulls' blitzing scheme, therefore having less players in coverage?
It's a good question. I think a lot of the big chunk plays were coverage mistakes, so you can attribute that to Bulls. That being said, you know, whenever you blitz, you're going to have less guys in coverage. I think that the young cornerback that they drafted in the second round, Sean Murphy Bunting, I think it was the 39th or 40th overall pick, he really struggled. He had one really bad blown coverage. MJ Stewart, who's a nickelback that they drafted last year in the second round, in like the 53, I think, he has struggled. He's been kind of hot and cold, but he did not have a good game on Sunday against the Giants. They've really just kind of struggled to develop. Carlton Davis didn't have a very good game on Sunday. They've struggled to develop their young corners. Vernon Hargraves has really come on this year. He was, you know, had a good one game last year before he, you know, got hurt. But they have struggled to develop their young corners to where they need to be. That being said, I think that they are good players, but, you know, they just need some seasoning, some more reps. It's tough for that position to immediately go in from college and then be, you know, as good as advertised. You rarely see guys like that outside of, you know, Denzel Ward, Marshawn Lattimore, and, you know, a handful of other guys, really.
You've seen it firsthand then. Like, the Giants drafted 3 corners in the draft this year, and DeAndre Baker was a first-round pick. He played at Georgia in the SEC, was a 3-year starter, and only gave up 1 touchdown in 3 years. Like, that's very, very impressive, playing in the best conference in college football. And he looked, you know, lost in the first 2 games. He wasn't playing press coverage at all, which is, you know, that's his strength in his game. And this week he kind of just put it all together, and he was playing, allowed to play more of those press coverages. And, you know, he looked like he knew what he was doing, but there's always going to be growing pains in these young defensive backs. And it's not easy for them to adjust in a pro style system. And especially one that we've heard from Bruce Arians himself on his conference call last week with reporters, said how his former defensive coordinator, James Betcher, who's now the Giants defensive coordinator, how his system's really hard for new and young players to learn. One question I had for you is, with the monstrous game that Mike Evans had, why did the Giants wait so long to start doubling him? You know, they had Janoris Jenkins shadowing him and covering him single coverage the whole first half, and Evans went off for two touchdowns and well over 100 yards in the first half.
Yeah,
and he had his three touchdowns. So, and then in the second half, he had no catches until the final drive of the game. He beat Jenkins again when, for whatever reason, on the most important drive of the game, they went back to that single high coverage.
Yep. Yeah. So again, that just kind of speaks to the game planning that they had. You know, they did dare Jameis to throw the ball deep, which I don't think is a terrible strategy, especially considering the running game has been doing pretty well. That being said, you know, once they started connecting, it really became a problem. They didn't really move back to that split safety look consistently until the second half. When they did do that, you know, it took a lot of, you know, Evans out of the game. But at the same time, the Bucs started running the ball a lot more to counter that seven in the box look instead of eight. So, yeah, for whatever reason, they went back to that coverage. I have no idea why they would go to, you know, a single high safety when the Bucs are looking to get a huge chunk play. To be honest, if Jameis Winston makes a little bit better throw, Mike Evans walks in for that touchdown, and it's, you know, the greatest ending I've ever seen in person. But unfortunately, that did not happen. I will give credit to Betcher. He made some good second half adjustments. I would question the in-game adjustments a little bit, just, you know, in real time, not without that, you know, that halftime break. But I think he could just do a better job reacting in real time to that.
Are the Bucks going to be looking for a new kicker this week?
No, actually, a very common thing is, you know, he missed a field goal, get him out of here. You know, the first, I don't really look at kicks on the All 22, but I did pay extra close attention to this year, to this game, and Matt Gay. So Matt Gay was a fifth round pick out of Utah. He was, Lou Groza Award, or the best kicker in the nation, basically. He's got a very strong leg, but he did play in altitude. So there is that. But, you know, his first kick in the preseason, he made a 55 yarder in Heinz Field, which is notoriously the hardest place to kick. He is a good kicker. That being said, his first extra point, he shanked left. The second extra point, which we talked about, Dexter Lawrence blocked, that was going to go in had that, you know, not been a great push by Lawrence and, you know, kind of impeded. He made four field goals before it, 52, 47, you know, and some shorter ones. That kick, for whatever reason, it looked like he didn't get his plant leg exactly where he wanted it. And the first extra point, I think, was a little bit in his head because that one went to the left. This one, it looks like he tried to get a little bit more down the middle and to the right, and he missed it by a couple feet, maybe a yard. So it was certainly a tough one, but he's going to bounce back. I have full confidence in him. That position has been a bugaboo for us for the last 10 years. Roberto Aguayo, obviously, being the, you know, most notable name, being a second-round kicker, was just horrendous. Matt Gay, I think, is actually really good. I'm going to give him a pass for that field goal. Obviously, he should have made it, but, you know, life goes on.
It's when it becomes habitual. That's when you have to cut the kicker.
Yeah. Arians kind of screwed him, too, because...
Yeah, but he made four before that.
And Arians kind of screwed him, too, because he took the delay of game penalty, pushing him back 5 yards.
There's some confusion about that. You know, he said that after the game that, you know, he did that on purpose. Pat McAfee actually had a really good explanation and said, you know, no way would anyone back the kicker up. The ball is in the middle of the field. He said maybe in college when the hashes are super wide, that could make sense, but there's no way that any coach would do that, you know, in the NFL. I think Arians were just kind of covering up for the offense. What happened was it was the 44-yard pass to Mike Evans. They spiked the ball. And then looking at it, the all 22 didn't really have a good shot of it. But what I think happened was that after they spiked the ball, they were kind of, there's 13. seconds left, they're confused about what they're going to do. They had one timeout left, and it was going to be, you know, are we kicking this now? Are we going to take a knee and, like, try and center the ball? So what ended up happening was they put the ball down after they spiked it. They got this big play, team celebrating. The refs immediately take the ball and place it down. When they do that, a 25-second clock starts. Typically, the team is at the line of scrimmage. I posted a cut-up of, you know, kind of what this looked like on TV. When they put the ball down, the team's not at the line of scrimmage, so the clock is running. The team gets there with about, I don't remember how much time was left, but with 13 seconds left on the play clock, which is still enough time to do something, you can see many members of the coaching staff kind of basically doing like a one hand raise the roof. That's the sign for reset the play clock to 25 seconds. Typically in that situation, that should not be an issue, especially with a stopped clock. For whatever reason, the refs did not reset the game clock. They took the penalty. I think it was smart to not use their timeout because hypothetically, if you do use the timeout and you get a penalty, the game could be over on a penalty or a false start. So I'm fine with that. I think everyone still expected him to make the kick again. He just made four field goals right before, including some from that range. It just kind of a bad break, and I think Aarons is just kind of covering up for, you know, it was a situational mistake for his team.
Yeah, well, it sounds like not the best ending, but to end on a high note here, Steve, and thanks for sure joining. You want to, I know you mentioned it before, but you have a big podcast episode dropping this Thursday. Do you want to kind of tell everyone again what that is, what to expect, et cetera?
Yep. Yeah. Appreciate that. So, we've got the Surf and Turf podcast with Tiki Barber. It's dropping, today, Thursday. A lot of really interesting things. We asked Tiki about Daniel Jones. We did this interview on Wednesday. I actually got to see him after over the weekend and at the game. We talked a little bit about Daniel Jones, but Tiki was really honest about his time with the Giants. He talked about his perceived feud with Eli Manning, about the comments about his comical leadership, which he actually gave full transparency about what happened. It's actually a very kind of messed up story where it was completely taken out of context from a dark recording of a preseason game where he was basically doing a test show for a network. He also talks about his feud with Tom Coughlin, which is very interesting. One of the quotes that I have that I just sent to our PR person was Coach Coughlin treated people like shit and he didn't realize it. He's a great coach, Coach Coughlin. I don't think he took the time to understand people until 07, and that's the year they won the Super Bowl. So just really interesting insight on his time with the Giants. Tiki makes some really good comparisons with Daniel Jones to Eli, and kind of he spent some time with Daniel Jones last year one-on-one just due to like a business venture and kind of a weird opportunity. And, you know, he gives some insight on that, and also some insight on the feud with him and Strahan going back to the early days where Tiki kind of criticized Michael Strahan's holdout. So some really interesting stuff on the Surf and Turf podcast with Tiki Barber.
Awesome. I will definitely be listening to that.
Yeah, that's going to be like, fun.
I'm hesitant to use this term, but it's an absolute must listen if you've been a Giants fan.
Yeah, well, we certainly will, Steven, that's for sure.
Yeah, it sounds like being a book.
And hey, Tampa Bay, the Bucs are ready to shine.
Hope so. It's a wide open division. I still have hope.
All right, Steven. Have a good night, man.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, no problem.
The Mets would have just dead team walking.
What a segue right into the Mets. How we doing, Frank?
They got a 2-1 homer from Conforto and nothing else. It's just... They're just not even trying tonight. They've got to fire Mickey Callaway. They just got to fire him.
Yeah, I mean, luckily we had Steven on so long, you know, to make this more of an NFL edition now with our baseball season being dead.
Hopefully we don't get to see Mickey Callaway wear number 26 very long.
Yeah, I agree. Of course, the Mets, what Frank's referencing is the Mets are retiring Jerry Kuzman's number 36.
You know, I was actually offended when Mickey Callaway wore number 36 to begin with. I've been wanting him to retire this number for a long time.
I was offended because he was wearing Sean Gilmartin's number, not Jerry Kuzman.
I was offended when Sean Gilmartin wore Jerry Kuzman's number. This is time. The Mets they're finally going to retire some of these numbers. I guess this means Gary Carter's number is going to be retired post haste. I mean, no one's worn 8 in 15 years.
Yeah, they were saying Carter, Keith Hernandez is number 17, and of course the captain, David Wright's number 5.
Are they going to think about doing Doc and Darryl? I mean, those two have to be considered.
Yeah,
curiously enough, maybe Willie Mays. They've only given it out on special occasions.
Ricky Henderson, of course. That's who I think is the last 24 on the Mets. One of the last. Oh, was Robbie Cano rocking 24 this year?
Robbie Cano is actually wearing 24.
He is. That's right. Okay. Well, you know, Cano's number will be retired by the time he's 41 and retires a Met.
Yeah. We're talking people who are like. I mean, Cano is a borderline Hall of Famer.
Yeah, he is. Just
and
not.
And they accidentally gave out number 24 in 1989 or 1990 to a guy named Kelvin Torvey.
Oh wow!
You never hear this story?
Never heard of that player.
Kelvin Torvey was one of these like losers that they called up from the minors, and nobody had worn 24 since Willie Mays stopped coaching. Because Willie Mays, after retiring, was a Mets coach for like 6 years. And then, 1990, they call up Kelvin Torvey. And without thinking about it, they allowed him to wear number 24. And he had like a good 3 or 4 games wearing 24. And people were saying, you know, you weren't supposed to give out this number. The Mets' original owner, Joan Payson, basically said, I'm retiring. I'm going to retire number 24 in honor of Willie Mays. When she died and the team got sold to the Wilpons, Mays left the organization and that promise got forgotten. And Kelvin Torvey accidentally got number 24. And then they realized what they did, and they told him, no, you can't wear this number, and they gave him 39, and then like the rest of his Met career, he's 1 for 40.
Oh God. Yeah, I mean, what the hell is going on with Noah Syndergaard?
He's got a $1 million arm and a 10-cent brain.
He's given up 4 runs in 4 straight outings for the first time in his career, dating back to August. He has a 7 ERA over that span, and he's gotten his personal cash for the last 2 starts, and he still stunk it out.
Well, I guess he wants Devin Mesoraco back.
Yeah, I mean, so DeGrom used that as he was DeGrom's personal catcher last year, and DeGrom is now the favorite to, you know, repeat his Cy Young without Mesoraco this whole year. So Syndergaard, it's a mental thing with him. It's his head.
It's going to be interesting. The Mets got to try to see if they could get something good for him. I'm at the point now where I think the Mets need to sign Wheeler and cut bait with Syndergaard.
I agree with half of that, Frank. I think that the Mets window, you know, is still open to win next year. They finally pretty much cut ties with the whole 2015 group, and now they have this new young core developed this year in the position players in Alonso, McNeil, Rosario, J.D. Davis, Nimmo, Conforto. So I think that, yes, they do need to re-sign Wheeler, and they should, you know, make a legitimate offer to him. But at the same time, as bad as Noah Syndergaard's been at times this year, he's still the pitcher that we know he's capable of being.
I'm tired of the bullshit.
I'm tired of the bullshit, too, but the thing is, you don't trade a pitcher like Syndergaard when you're claiming to compete.
Well, I'm not going to trade him and get nothing for him. I want something legitimate. I don't even want prospects for him. And I actually think, crazy as it might sound, I heard a trade proposal that actually might work.
What would that be?
The Syndergaard, Conforto, and perhaps even Ed Luis Diaz. All going in one trade. Mets get a prospect back and Mookie Betts.
Was that Anthony Martino's or Andy Martino's proposal?
I think it might have been.
Well,
that was
top prospect.
That was just a scenario, though. I don't. That's not like an actual legitimate.
Like that's like giving up everything.
Yeah, it's not. It won't happen. And the thing is, they shouldn't trade Syndergaard. I don't trust this regime to get value back for Noah Syndergaard. He's going to go somewhere else.
Well, that's the thing that frightens me. But you know, right now, what's he doing? Why has he regressed every year now for 3 straight years?
It does. Well, injuries have slowed him down. And the thing is, he had a tough April, and then once mid-May came around, he got his slider back, and you know he pitched very, very well from mid-May on up until these last 4 starts. But he's really the worst part is it really sticks out now because the team needed him badly over the last month, and he folded like a cheap tent.
You know the Mets should trade him to see if the Rockies have any prospects to give up. That's the place he deserves to pitch.
God.
I don't trust the Mets either, Pat. I really don't. Like,
neither do. I don't either. So
I'm at the point where I would rather them just let all of these guys play out their contracts, and if they go, they go. Because I'd rather try and win, because that's the only way the Mets can win. Is they need a little bit of luck, a lot of luck, everything to break their way, and for everyone to play it at their top level, because they have the talent. Like, it's basically if it's not like 2015, we're done. Because the front office will never give us the tools we need to be a top contender from wire to wire.
Well, the one thing that's necessary is they need a new manager. I hope what I understand to be the rumor is true that Brody does not like Mickey Callaway.
It would make sense for Brody to want to bring in his own manager, too, and he absolutely should, despite this team finishing with a winning record for the third time in 11 years. But at the same time, this is the third winning record they've had since 2015.
But there's five to ten games that he cost them, exactly. And they're going to miss the playoffs by about 5 to 10 games.
Exactly. And the thing is, though, yes, he cost them a bunch of wins, and then also at the same time, if the bullpen was just mediocre, the bullpen was just bad, let's say that, and not abysmal, they would be in the playoffs, or at least be in it until the last day, you know, still only probably a game or two out. The thing is that in the wish list this offseason, they need a manager and a bullpen, and then try and re-sign Wheeler, and then I would honestly just do small moves after that, because their position players are set for next year. I would honestly, as much as we hate on Todd Frazier on this show, Todd Frazier and Juan Lagares coming back for cheap deals.
No.
Not even as part-time players. And Joe Panik. Definitely bring back Joe Panik.
Oh, I'll bring back Panik, definitely.
Yeah. I just mean, Frazier gave you 22 home runs this year as a part-time player.
And no, it's time to cut bait with him. It's time to cut bait. The hope is that the mystery man from Cuba has the desire to still play baseball, and knowing and seeing that it's his contract year, comes out and plays like he plays in contract years and becomes Jonas Cespedes again.
I think they should think about signing, if they don't bring back Lagares on a cheap deal as a backup, they should look into bringing in Jerrod Dyson.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
His speed and his glove and his ability to play center field could be very valuable for them.
All right. I don't have the Met game because my SNY is not working, but the Mets just tied the game.
Oh, and I'm delayed. Thank you for telling me that, Frank. Conforto cranked his 33rd home run of the year to tie the game in the ninth. Right in the right center field bleachers. That was
unfortunately. I turn on SNY, I get a blank screen, and files to tell me I have to reset everything. So, and I can't do that because that would mean I have to reset my internet too. So I have to wait until after the podcast is over to do it.
Frank, I feel like me and you, when we don't watch the Mets games, I feel like that's when they do their best.
Well, I think I take my sleep shifts sometimes. I take my sleep shifts. I wake up and they're winning, and I know that it's a good. I tried to watch the games in the beginning this year, and that was April and May, and they weren't doing too good. So I just went to my sleep shifts a lot in July, and then I wake up and they're up a couple runs. And, oh, okay, this is good. This might be a good game to watch.
It's so true. Hey, did you see the Mike Francesa's movie trailer debut today in the Adam Sandler movie.
that 11-second clip is now going to be is going to haunt him.
Yeah, he got literally everyone from Barstool now were already licking their chops at KFC. That was a terrible fucking bet. And someone actually called into the show today saying, "Mike, whose balls did you got to fondle to get that gig?" He goes, hangs up. He goes, "Okay, this guy." He goes, "This guy's a fool." He goes, "They're just jealous. They're jealous."
You know, if he didn't respond to it, if he, you know, you could actually delete the whole call.
I know. Yeah, there's clips where you don't even get to hear what the person said because Mike just cuts them off.
And if he doesn't say that, then what would? Oh, okay, let's move on to the next call. I mean, that would have been the thing to do. No one would have had that.
Well, our good friend of the show, Big Action Bill, actually caught the clip and posted it.
But yeah, Funhouse put it on.
Funhouse did. I for whatever reason, I thought that Bill posted it himself. It didn't look like it came from Funhouse.
I think Funhouse might have retweeted it, or one of them retweeted it.
Retweeted it, yeah. Well,
because, you know, Funhouse always does it. Funhouse catches everything.
He's incredible. He really is.
We have to see if we can get him on again. I think I had him on once before.
You had Funhouse on last year?
Yeah, if I can recall right.
Damn, he doesn't follow me. I don't know. He might follow our podcast account. That maybe Nick could get in contact with him. But, you know, he favorites my stuff from time to time if I tag him in some things. But he doesn't follow me. So, you know, it's kind of hard to. It's kind of hard, you know, when guys' DMs aren't open, if you don't follow them, then, you know, it's kind of hard to get in contact with them. But luckily we got, you know, Big Action Bill responded to my reply. We had him on for a great show a couple weeks, of course. You're not watching the Mets game right now, but Rosario just singled, and now there's a runner. Rosario's on first with no outs.
I'm watching it on the Game Day app. So that's how I'm getting able to watch it.
Todd Frazier's up now with Rosario on first. I think we could expect to see Rosario try and steal a bag here, get in scoring position.
Well, yesterday Todd Frazier showed why he should not be back when he struck out with the bases loaded. Of course, you know who my dream scenario is next year. And it's pie in the sky. They're probably not going to get this guy.
Anthony Rendon.
For two reasons. One, I'm tired of him beating on the fucking Mets. And two, he's a good leader.
Hey, but the thing is now, I mean, Rendon's clearly not going to happen as much as we'd love it. You know, he's an MVP candidate this year. Honestly, in my book, he's the NL MVP. But the thing is, the excuse to not play McNeil at third base full time was because he didn't have power, and you want power at the corners. McNeil has 23 home runs this year.
Too many home runs. I think he needs to go back to slapping it.
He should. Yeah, he really hasn't looked like himself since coming back from the IL a month ago.
But yeah. I don't think he's 100% healthy. I clearly agree with that.
No, yeah, and this isn't the first leg injury. This isn't the first hamstring injury he had this year either. So
no, he's someone who is going to need the offseason. He's going to need November to nice bath.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with you. But yeah, for the most part, I don't understand people saying, "Oh, McNeil should be the starting left fielder and J.D. Davis should be the starting third baseman next year." No way. Davis is not a good third baseman. McNeil's an above-average third baseman, and J.D. Davis really isn't bad in left field. He's no Dom Smith.
You know who Jeff McNeil is, ironically enough?
He reminds me of Ben Zobrist and Daniel Murphy. That's why I love him so much.
No, there's another guy he reminds me of.
Who would that be?
Jed Lowry.
Who? Who is that guy? I never heard of him.
You know, Jed Lowry is basically Ben Zobrist. That's why the Mets got him.
Yeah, but he certainly did not look like Ben Zobrist this year.
He even playing? I mean, he had like one at bat.
He batted. I've seen him get two at bats, and he doesn't have a hit this year, and he hasn't started or played the field. He's pinch hit twice.
So he never came back.
They wasted $10 million on fucking Jed Lowry this year when they had the dog shit bullpen.
And you know, the ironic thing is, when they tried to sign that as Drupal Cabrera told him, "Fuck you, you got Jed Lowry."
Yeah, well, he wasn't happy they didn't re-sign him.
No, he wanted to come back, and they chose Jed Lowry instead.
Yep. Now the Mets have two outs. Frazier popped out, of course, the second, and Ramos just lined out the third.
Naturally. That's what fucking Frazier does. That's why I don't want Frazier back.
Well, I don't know why they're not trying to have Rosario swipe a bag and get in the scoring position.
Because their manager's not smart. That's why.
The thing, like, who are they gonna bring in relief? They already pitched their top three relievers. They're gonna have to bring in Brad Brock again.
This is why Mickey Callaway sucks. This is why Mickey Callaway has to be fired. He is a horrible in-game manager.
From last week in Colorado, keeping Rene Rivera in to pinch hit with the bases loaded, that almost cost them the game, to the countless errors he makes. Bring in Walter Lockett last night when they cut the deficit to two runs, and he brought in Walter Lockett, who walked the leadoff guy and then gave up a hit.
He does not have a feel for the game ever.
Why not just bring Brock in to start that inning? That's what I don't understand.
And there's going to be plenty of managerial options. I'm actually here now even talking about a guy whose name I've heard of, who is on the Yankees staff, now on the Astros staff. So I think it's 80% that Mickey's gone.
Who is it?
What was the guy's name that they were talking about?
Well, as long as it's not a fucking another pitching coach.
I think he was a Yankee dirt base coach. Now he's like the Astros bench coach.
Any former catcher or bench coach is a good managerial candidate because they know how to control the game. They have a feel for the game.
Yes, the name came out today. I clicked on the article. It was a CBS Sportsline article. Buster Olmey even mentioned it. Joe Espada.
Okay. I think I've heard that name.
He was the Yankee dirt base coach. Now he's the Astros bench coach.
I mean, that's not a bad idea. Of course, you know, the pipe dream of mine and yours is to bring in Girardi, but they're not going to pay Girardi.
Well, Girardi could get his dream job this year.
What would that be, the Cubs?
Yeah. Although I don't think the OSP wants to deal with him.
Yeah, and the thing is, Girardi's going to demand probably at least $5 million a year.
Which is why the Mets aren't going to deal with him.
Exactly, and he made $4 million a year with the Yankees, so.
I think Dave Ross ends up going to Chicago. I mean, why not take the Cubs are going for a managerial change, why not change go for the Cubs manager?
Yeah, I think that I'm really in love with the fact of, you know, of catchers being managers. I think that catchers are very, very good managers.
I don't know what Joe Espada's position was, but
he was a former player, though, right?
I don't know. I don't remember him as a player.
I was gonna say I'm pretty sure Sports Encyclopedia would know that.
I mean, if this guy was a player, he was a minor league player or in between player that maybe came up with a game or two here or there.
Uh-huh.
And those guys I don't always remember well. I heard did one guy I wouldn't mind them talking about is Tim Bogar, who even though he sucked as a Met.
Yeah.
Tim
Bozo, Frank?
Yeah, Tim Bozo. That's what I called him as a player. His best game ever, he hit inside the park home run and ended up destroying his, separating his shoulder. Yeah, career minor leaguer, never made it up to the majors. Middle infielder. Played for, toiled in the minors for a number of years.
The Phillies absolutely suck. They blew a two-run lead to the Nationals, and they wound up losing 6-5.
Oh, yeah. Well, here's a nightmare scenario. We're going to have to deal with Girardi in our division.
You think he's going to – I don't think he'll go to the Phillies. I don't think he'd want
to. He's totally going to the Phillies.
I don't think he'd want to.
No, the Phillies are going to get a new manager. Gabe Kapler is going to get fired, and when it comes to managers, I think Mickey Callaway actually might be a better manager than Gabe Kapler.
I agree with you. I think Kapler's number 30 and Callaway's 29th best. But the Phillies have one pitcher, and his name's Aaron Nola.
Oh, yeah, we talk about Jake Arrieta. Woo! There's some wasted money.
Yeah, oh, he sucks. God.
Here we are, 10th inning, and look who's coming in. Familia.
I'm delayed on my streaming and online, but, you know, they're not. I mean, Familia's not half as bad as Ed Lewis, but, you know, Ed Lewis actually has six scoreless innings in his last couple outings. He struck out two batters last night. Well. Yeah, well, tonight I'll probably give up the go-ahead home run. If they lose tonight, I'm pretty sure they're eliminated, right? Because the Nationals won.
Yep.
So, I mean, we could start moving towards ending the show, or we could wait to see what happened, what unfolds.
It's not worth it. It's not worth waiting. Especially since I don't have the TV.
That's fair. Frank, one other thing I wanted to ask you about before we start to wrap things up. You're obviously someone who...
Did we lose Nick?
Nick actually had to step out. He had to go.
Oh.
Yeah, he left a good 10 minutes ago. But, so you actually... I think your power of the mush actually helped out the Giants on Sunday, speaking about that game for the first hour or so of the show before. When Barkley got injured, you said, there goes Dave Gettleman's last good move. And then Daniel Jones proceeded in going off, and the other rookies had good games.
I was saying that Mike Francesa is licking his chops.
Yeah, well, he still wouldn't even give good credit. He goes, okay, here was an out post-game analysis. He goes, the kid had a good game, okay? It was one game. Because he's mad at the Giants, so, like,
the Giants lost that game 41-10. And Saquon Barkley out for 8 weeks. He go, well, this is why you should have drafted a quarterback last year. I told you to draft a quarterback last year, but you didn't listen. No, I know. I'm the great sports pope. Hallelujah. Hallelujah. That's the worst fucking draft pick in the world.
Here's one thing, you know, that people disregard, and I wish I could have. I wanted to mention this when we were talking to Steve, but I didn't get a chance to. Gettleman brought in 6 starters last year in the draft and rookie free agency. Then this year, now he has 4 more starters, and that's not even including Darius Slayton and O'Shane Zeminis, their third-round pick, who look like starters, and they've contributed in these first couple games. Gettleman knows how to draft. And, like, despite the national narrative against him, I know these guys are young, these players are young, and, you know, they haven't really proven much yet, but they've proven that they belong on the field. They've flashed the talent that they belong there and could potentially be starters and have held their own at the least. And that's something Jerry Reese was unable to do for many years.
Now, Reese rests on his laurels after the Super Bowls.
It's because he built off Ernie Accorsi's core, and then he drafted guys. The list goes on and on and on. He goes Adrian Robinson, Marvin Austin, Jarrell Jernigan, DeMontre Moore, Owa, Weston Richburg, Justin
Eric
Pugh,
Flowers.
Eli Apple, Eric Flowers. The guy was incompetent, Frank. He was incompetent. And his head scout, Mark Ross, was incompetent, who they love to have on NFL Network now, saying, ah, ha, ha, look at the Giants. That's what he was doing last year. The Giants are terrible. When he created that mess with the other fucking stooge, Jerry Reese, running the show.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? Do you remember Mark Ross, the Giants head scout, going on and bashing them last year? Like, he didn't, like, blaming Gettleman for the mess that he fucking helped create?
Oh, boy. That takes nerve.
A lot of nerve. But, you know, I'm happy. People tell me I'm too positive about the Giants and optimistic, but they're headed in the right direction. You know, it sucks that Saquon's going to miss probably a month and a half to 2 months. But, you know, very excited to see what Daniel Jones does. And, you know, they should at least pick up a win against the lowly Redskins, who were an embarrassment. Well, got drummed off the field last night.
The Redskins won't be playing on Monday Night Football. You ever see the Redskins' Monday Night numbers?
Probably pretty poor, right?
Let's put it this way. The Boomtown Rats song, I Don't Like Mondays, should play over and over again on Endless Loop when the Redskins are playing on Monday Night Football.
God. The Washington Garfields.
I mean, the Washington, the song the I Don't Like Mondays, that should replace Hail to the Redskins. In the since 2000, they're 5-24 on Monday Night Football. They're 3-8. They were 3-17 in their last 20 coming in. So that means they're now 3-18 in their last 21. 2-17 all time at FedEx Field on Monday Night Football, and they've lost their last 8.
Oh my God, Dan Snyder's Dan Snyder's the only owner in sports who's worse. Well, and James Dolan, they're worse than the Wilpons.
And by the way, most of these losses are by like 10 points or more.
That's brutal.
They're like, the games aren't even close. They're not losing heartbreakers. They're getting blown out on Monday Night Football.
Yeah, I mean, last night was no better. Case Keenum, that play of Case Keenum trying to dive over the pile and getting absolutely
The Bears fell asleep. Mitchell Trubisky had a terrible second half. I was worried that my sure thing bet was going to lose. I mean, there's no the closest thing to a sure thing bet in the NFL is the bet picking against the Redskins on Monday Night Football.
Yeah, that's
and it was 28-0. All of a sudden now it's 28-13. They're coming back and they get a touchdown there. All of a sudden it's a one score game.
Yeah, I mean the Redskins are
actually it was the score. So they just get a touchdown there. It's a one score game. And 4th-and-1 instead of rolling, doing a run, and everyone on the Bears knew what play was coming.
Yeah, that's an embarrassment. The Redskins are a joke, and that they're going to be picking probably in the top 5 this year in the draft. They look terrible.
You know, when I was doing my picks at the beginning of the season, and I figured the Dolphins would go 1-15, they were the one.
Yeah, that's fair. And I think that I don't think there's any way, and I hope I don't have to eat my words next week, but I don't think there's any way the Giants are losing at home to the fucking Redskins.
I mean, the things are so bad right now. It's you could almost get this song stuck in your head. Fail to the Redskins. Fail to move the ball. They're going backwards. Time to punt again.
Want to know what's even more embarrassing? As bad as this team is, Dwayne Haskins can't even start at quarterback. I heard he doesn't even know how to run the plays.
And boy, could you imagine the Giants almost that were talking about getting him?
Oh no!
Everyone said the Giants should get him.
Everyone yelled and said Gettleman was clueless for drafting Jones over Dwayne Haskins.
Dwayne Haskins. First off, name for me one Ohio State quarterback that's ever been good.
Nobody, and he looks like.
Maybe there is one. I'm not 100% sure. Maybe Otto Graham went to Ohio State, but that was about 75 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. In the modern era, all Ohio State quarterbacks have been system quarterbacks. They have not succeeded in the NFL. And you could see it with Haskins. Haskins has a nice arm. Occasionally, he's accurate, but he really, for the most part, he's not. He's not consistently accurate.
Ohio State turned, if you want a lineman, offensive lineman, defensive lineman, you go to, you get, that's what you get out of Ohio State. Maybe a wide receiver here and there, too.
And a running back in Ezekiel Elliott and Carlos Hyde.
Yeah, but other than that, I can't name one all-pro quarterback that's ever come out of Ohio State. They had a guy who came out of Ohio State, was going to be good, could have been good, and he ended up being like a degenerate gambler.
God. Pete Rose.
Worse than Pete Rose.
Oof. What was his name?
Art Schleister.
I've heard of him.
Art Schleister, this guy was a starter for the Baltimore Colts, and he had a good, he showed signs of being good, and then he got suspended for gambling. The Colts, of course, tried to draft John O, and he said, no, I don't want to go to Baltimore. And then he ended up getting kicked out of the league, played in arena football, got in trouble in arena football for betting on games. And last I heard, and he's been in and out of prison for like fraud and doing all of this and that. Yeah, he's even worse than Pete Rose.
is.
But that when I think of Kent Graham. There's another guy that went to Ohio State.
Yep, he beat the undefeated Broncos in 1998 for the Giants.
Do you know who the most famous quarterback right now out of Ohio State is? Kirk Herbstreit.
And Cardale Jones, too, though.
Yeah, but we're talking the guys who no significant NFL playing time, that time at quarterback.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, Kirk Herbstreit's an announcer. But he is a quarterback at Ohio State. Those are the type of quarterbacks Ohio State has.
That's right. So, on that note, I think we should wrap it up for the week. We had a short week, of course. Normally, we record the show on Wednesdays, but this week, because of scheduling conflicts, we did Tuesday. So we gave it
We might have to do Tuesdays here and there too.
Yep. Possibly next week too, as I'm traveling to work again next week, so got a busy couple weeks. But thanks for everyone who listened to another episode of Allow Me to Be Frank. Remember to download, rate, review, and subscribe.
And of course, if you see my Lions pick, go the opposite, because the Lions always fuck me.
Always go the opposite of Frankie Mush.
Come fade away, my picks. Come fade away, my picks. Look at Mickey Calloway is smiling. Look at Mickey Calloway.